everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host, Red Sale, and in today's show, we'll hear some short stories prompted by the word rebel.
I couldn't muster that embrace. Boys don't cry. Fair enough.
Just become what folks' perceptions of a wee disabled person should be in day.
So for the first time in my life, I found a job of my own.
There is an art to it, a finesse, a certain je ne sais quoi that you do not seem to possess.
A woman in a Range Rover has nearly crashed because she's staring so much. It's almost as if the north of Scotland has never seen a drag nun before.
Yes, it's that time of year again. It's Book Week Scotland. And in today's show, we'll hear selections of this year's free book from the Scottish Book Trust. We'll find out about that in a moment.
The book is free and available in print from Scottish bookshops and libraries. Or, if you're elsewhere, you can download the ebook and audiobook versions.
We'll find out how to get your free copy later on in the show.
But first, let's hear from the people behind Book Week Scotland, the Scottish Book Trust. Robert Kirkwood talked to Philippa Cochrane.
Hi, I'm Philippa Cochrane. I'm Head of Reader Development at Scottish Book Trust. We are a national organisation and we all passionately believe that reading and writing and books and the pleasure of getting involved in all that and having it in your everyday personal life is of huge benefit to people across the country. So we exist to encourage, support and inspire people to read and write more.
So first of all, how do you encourage people to read more?
A variety of ways. We work with a whole range of different audience groups across the country, so we provide the Book Bug scheme for early years, for new families with young children, where we gift books into the home. We also provide a schools programme that does touring and children's book awards and live events with the BBC to get kids excited about books and bring them into contact with authors and to encourage them to talk about books with one another. And we run a writer development programme, which is about encouraging writers to take their writing further, whether they're just starting out or whether they're quite committed professionals. And then we also run a number of schemes that anyone can get involved in, aimed more at sort of the general adult public. We run an annual campaign where people can tell us their stories around a particular theme. We run Book Week Scotland, which is the annual national celebration of reading that takes place in November. And we also work very closely with libraries and provide things like readers in residence to libraries around the country to support them to go out and engage with people in their communities.
And of course, you are the driving force behind the reason you're here. You've mentioned it before, but tell us more about Book Week Scotland.
Book Week Scotland, the straightforward answer is exactly what it says it is. It's a national celebration of reading and books and words and stories and the joy that we all get from them and reading for ourselves and sharing them. That happens in November. And for the entirety of that week, all around the country, there are events happening in every local authority. So we work very closely with the libraries. The libraries are a really central part of Book Week Scotland. Mm. And they deliver events through the library services in every local authority. But we also work with a whole range of other partners so they might be arts organisations, they might be community groups, they might be businesses, they might be schools. And they all get involved in the celebration in one way or another. There's things for all ages. There's things for all sort of reading interests. It's very much we are encouraging people to be sociable about their reading and the books that they enjoy. So encouraging people to talk about things that they enjoy, swap books with one another, maybe try something new. All sorts of things going on.
As we've heard, this year's free book for Book Week Scotland is called Rebel. It's a collection of short stories and poems written by the public and by some of Scotland's most talented authors. It's the culmination of a three-month-long writing project run by the Scottish Book Trust during 2018. Whether you're a rebel without a cause or a trailblazing activist, the Scottish public were encouraged to share their stories. It doesn't matter whether it was skiving school during the glory days of your youth, taking a stand against the establishment, or pinching the last biscuit from the tin. The Scottish public were asked, what does rebel mean to you?
Everybody rebels. It's part of what makes us human to occasionally do the things we know we shouldn't, say the things we know will provoke, or fight against the things we believe are unjust. Rebellion incites opposition and change, allows us to find our own individual voices, and inspires future generations to challenge convention and expectation.
The stories were selected from hundreds that were sent to the Scottish Book Trust. And again, this year, working with RNIB, most of the stories were read by the authors themselves, either recorded in their own homes or in the RNIB Talking Book Studios in Glasgow.
The complete audiobook of Rebel is nearly 3 hours long, with 39 stories. We've only got an hour, so we might have room for around 10. All the stories in the book are fantastic, and the following were chosen only for time reasons and for containing things we could broadcast. Stories like They Boots, How to Inadvertently Start a Coup, and especially Bad Words would get us taken off the air. So, here's the first in our broadcastable batch of stories from the Book Week Scotland book, Rebel.
Jenny's Well, written and read by Ray Cowie. I didn't have room, not with my sandwiches, fruit gums, bag of salt and shake and bottle of orange squash. The new jersey was all thick and scratchy, knitted with sickly green iron wool. Night after night, Mum's needles kept clicking. Every now and then, she would measure it against my back. She sewed it up, the chunky needle flying back and forth, as she watched Coronation Street. Sunbeams were bouncing off the pavement. It would weigh me down. But nobody argued with Mum. I stuffed the woolly mass into the plastic carrier bag on top of my picnic and set off with my pal. We traipsed downhill beneath heavy stone viaducts past a circle of caravans that came in the summer with waltzers and sticky candy floss. We nipped over the golf course, across sandy links with the whole day stretched ahead of us, bright as the glistening rollers rumbling ashore. We picked our way steadily between briny rock pools, slipping sometimes, causing a salty trail to rim our leather sandals. That would be another telling off. I licked my fingertips, bending to rub at the worst of it. We tore off our sandals, letting them dangle in our grasp as chilly waves sucked on our ankle bones. High above, gulls squawked for attention in the overhang of the cliffs as we clambered over boulders until we made it to Jenny's Well. Someone had traced her name in beach pebbles, letters stuck roughly in cement. Not that it mattered. Nobody remembered much about Jenny. Some said maidens, all dressed in white, used to come on May Day to drink from the well to ensure good health. Maybe Jenny was one of those, but we doubted it. It didn't sound like the kind of thing folk round here would do. We preferred creepy stories of the mad woman who lived in a nearby cave or of the poor travelling girl who died and was buried there, tales guaranteed to make us shiver. The water ran clear and fresh as we cupped our hands, dipping our heads, making a wish as we drank. We tucked our picnics amongst the rocks and stripped off to our swimsuits, screeching at the sky as the sea clasped first our calves, then our thighs, then our waists, until we could wait no more for it to swallow us. We took short, sharp strokes that matched our breath until our stomachs reminded us it was lunchtime. I munched on limp ham and swigged at warm squash. I knew I wasn't to leave litter, so stuffed the ball of tinfoil and greasy crisp packet back into the carrier. Heat from the rocks seeped through our towels, warming our backs as we whispered about boys. It was the chill in the air that warned us we should think of home. Supper, maybe a plate of macaroni or pie and beans, would be waiting on the table, sharp at 5. I'd be in for another row. The sun slid behind clouds, and I remembered the knitted jersey. I tugged it free from the bag, staring at Mam's intricate handiwork. She'd taught me how to do some of it. Dainty moss stitch, as well as cable stitch winding like fishermen's ropes. What was left of my drink had leaked across the front of it. I dunked the dainty moss and winding cable stitches beneath the flow of the well, scrubbing them as best I could. The wet wool weighed as heavy as my heart when I hauled it up onto the clean boulder, the clawing damp smell of it turning my stomach. If I held it in shadow, maybe Mum wouldn't notice the stain. My tongue clamped hard to the roof of my mouth, dry as the seaweed littering the top of the shoreline near the spiky grass. I squeezed at the jersey until my knuckles grew white. Then my pal had a go, just to be sure. Then I thought it might dry with my body heat, so I pulled it over my head, brushing aside the fact that now it almost touched my knees. But wool shrank when it was washed. My jersey just needed time. So we dandered back across the rocks and the sands and the golf course, past the show caravans with their flashing lights. The jersey clung to my thighs as we dragged our feet uphill, until the smell from the chippers became too much, and we stopped to eat some that turned dense and claggy in my mouth. I rummaged in my plastic bag, unscrewing the bottle top, guzzling the remaining dribble of squash. Once she'd finished with the chips, my pal made for home, but my jersey was still soaking. Then I remembered Mum hangs jerseys out to dry. There was a swing set beside the chippers, so I gripped the rusty chains, kicking high as I could, then higher still, swinging on and on until the sea turned peach, darker pink near the horizon. Past the viaducts and the pulsing blink of the waltzers, dark shadows of the cliffs began stretching like fingers out over the sands. It was too dark to see Jenny's well, and still I kicked, back and forth, back and forth. I knew by the way the car door slammed that it was Mum. I didn't need to hear her roar. I tucked in my chin and flung myself back, forcing the swing to creak as the salty toes of my sandals reached for the first of the evening stars.
Rover, written and read by Todd Sharkey. We all went round to Stephen's house that afternoon. Me, Dario, Craig and the twins, Derek and Brian. It was 2003 and we were all 10 years old, apart from Craig, who was not only older, but taller too. Even at such a young age, we all felt the seriousness of the situation. It was the day of Stephen's dad's funeral. It was supposed to be summer, but the weather had a Scottish sense of humour. It was the kind of rain that hit you on the way down and splashed you on the way up. We walked in silence around the corner of the terrace house to Stephen's front door. That's where we found him, sat on the doorstep in a black suit and tie, head hanging as he stared at the concrete. He heard a splash towards him and looked up. "You okay, Steve?" I asked, knowing damn well that was a stupid question. "I'm fine, just tired. Want to go for a walk?" he said, trying to shrug off the enormous elephant. We all agreed to go for a walk through the park. It was our favourite place to be when things were good, but on this day, the rain-drenched national park seemed to be a cold and unforgiving shadow of the past, creeping over our shoulders and whispering into our ears that life would never be the same again. Stephen's dad was one of those people that could make anything fun. He was a bricklayer by trade, but a comedian by nature. He always treated us as family. We all felt a pain as we watched the cancer eat him alive. We could never have imagined how it affected Steve. Steve stopped and leaned against a twisted tree trunk. The rain got heavier, so we all huddled beneath its branches. Right then, I wanted to hug my friend. I wanted to tell him that everything was going to be okay. It wasn't, but damn it, I would lie to him until he believed me. I found out recently that we all had that same instinct. Hell, Dario actually went in for the hug, but he patted Steve's shoulder instead. I couldn't muster that embrace. "Boys, don't cry." "Fair enough." "Mum gave the car away," Steve said. It was the first he had spoken in a while and it took us all by surprise. "A big lorry came this morning and took it away." I looked around at the others. They all had the same look on their face, trying to look concerned but being totally confused at the same time. "I liked that car. It was a nice colour." Craig. Simple Craig, bless him. At least he said something. "Beetroot. Dad said it was the colour of beetroot." He hated beetroot. We all saw it. The small smile appeared on Steve's face, but as quick as it came, it vanished. Dad and I left something in the car. I wish I could have got it back before they took it away. Derek jumped on the spot. "Let's go and get it," he said, excited. "Do you know where the car is?" "Bank scrapyard." Or at least that's what the lorry had on the side. It was Brian's turn to jump. "Come on, let's go." The next thing I knew, we were loitering around outside the fenced-off scrapyard. Dario was a smooth talker, so we sent him into the office to explain the situation to the owner. He returned with bad news. He said we can't go in, and your mum should come along if she wants something from the car. If he catches us sneaking in, he's calling the police. I took a leg up from Craig to get a better angle at the yard. There it was, a beetroot-coloured Rover 416. I read out the registration plate to Steve and he confirmed it. We needed a plan. The twins were the fastest runners, so they would stay outside and distract the man. Craig would give Dario, Steve and I a leg over the fence. Dario said he could pick locks, so he was the locksmith. Steve was going to grab the treasure and I was the lookout because I had elf eyes like Legolas. The twins did their part, bashing on the windows of the office with sticks and rocks. The man flew out and chased them. They booked it for Main Street. I put my foot in Craig's hand and he threw me over the fence. Steve came next, then Dario. Craig stayed by the fence as the rest of us made for the Rover. We all did our best James Bond impression, rolling around in the mud, leaping over scrap metal and sliding over the bonnets of cars. This was serious work, but goddammit, we were having fun. We met at the car and it was time for Dario's lockpicking skills. He picked up the nearest brick and smashed the driver's side window. The alarm began blaring instantly. Steve opened the door. I kept my eyes trained on the gate. Stephen pressed the tape eject button and the cassette popped out. He pocketed it and we sprinted to Craig. I could hear the yard owner screaming above the alarm behind us. We scaled the fence ourselves with the miracle of adrenaline and ran all the way back to Steve's. The twins were waiting on us when we arrived. We went inside and upstairs to his room. He found his dad's tape player and snapped the cassette inside. He pushed play. The first thing we heard was John Wayne shouting, "Fill your hand, you son of a bitch." Then it went straight into Bob Dylan's Subterranean Homesick Blues. Steve put his head in his hand and broke into tears. We huddled around him and joined in. Arm in arm, we supported him and each other. Sometimes boys do cry.
None of Your Business, written and read by novice Carmen Eileen. It's 10 a.m. on a warm May morning and I'm walking into Aberdeen city centre with my friend. A man's jaw has just fallen open and he's walked several feet into the road to avoid being near me. A woman in a Range Rover has nearly crashed because she's staring so much. It's almost as if the north of Scotland has never seen a drag nun before. We're used to seeing nuns portrayed as sprightly, twinkly-eyed singing Marias or austere, disapproving matrons in grim convent dramas. But queer ones covered in grease paint and glitter don't spring instantly to mind. Once they do, it's somewhat hard to shake the image. The Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence were rebels at a time of devastation in the gay community of 70 San Francisco. The Catholic Church had turned their backs on the suffering of AIDS victims, and there was nowhere else for them to seek comfort. So on the pretense of staging a performance of The Sound of Music, three gay men borrowed some nuns' habits and toured the bars of the Castro district, drawing attention to the social conflicts there. This small act of rebellion spread like sparkly rainbow wildfire, and now there are sisters all over the world ministering to the queer masses. That's why I'm standing on Aberdeen's main street, with a growing crowd cooing over my glitter makeup and jewellery so copious it would put Lily Savage to shame. Because there's no better way to draw attention to the crime still committed against the LGBTQ+ community than to turn up to Grampian's first pride as a sister. At a time when homosexuality was still taboo, the sisters appearing in the streets was the ultimate act of defiance. So great was a sister's reach that by the late 80s, one ran for office in San Francisco, listing her occupation as none of the above. A law was swiftly passed requiring candidates to use their legal name. The sisters elegantly stuck the boot, or stiletto, into the establishment, and they continue their colourful activism to this day. I've made it several yards into the Pride March, and I've already been photographed for a newspaper. Some awestruck teenage girls have asked me how long it took to do my makeup. 1.5 hours, and most of that clearing up glitter. They tell me my rainbow eyelashes are beautiful. I'm glad, because they took up the rest of that getting ready time. but being a rebel involves more hard work than putting on makeup. Sisters take vows, like any nuns, to spread universal joy and banish guilt. You might see them handing out safe sex packs or shaking buckets for LGBTQ+ charities. Sometimes they're just there for people who have recently come out, who might face being disowned by loved ones. The veils and fancy dresses look happy, but there's an anger bubbling beneath the surface of many of my fellow activists. I'm eating a 99 on the beach in glorious weather, with hindsight a foolish thing in pristine white makeup. My friends sticking to me like glue in case we get any trouble from locals. But our worries melt faster than the ice cream when a young boy gives me a bashful wave. His parents smile and say, "Isn't that nice, those two men in love?" Like many others, they assume I'm a man in drag. Nobody needs to know what's really under the grease paint. Gender doesn't matter anyway. No organisation's perfect, and sisters squabble like any family. But having a worldwide bunch of glamorous siblings, choosing to be angry, deciding to be visible for those who can't, makes me feel like the rebellion might just win the day, and look fabulous while doing it.
We'll have more from this year's Book Week Scotland book, Rebels, in a moment. But first, let's hear from the people behind Book Week Scotland, the Scottish Book Trust.
I'm Katrine Armstrong. I'm the Head of Writer Development here at Scottish Book Trust, and my job involves mainly looking after writers. We look after writers of all ages and at various different stages at Scottish Book Trust. We run mentoring, training, we provide advice and resources. We run an award scheme for young writers, we run another award scheme for new writers, we provide mentoring for established writers. We run labs for writers who want to try working in a different medium. And we're just here over the phone or by email if you have any specific questions about writing or your writing career. And we've also got all sorts of great things online for people to participate in, either finding out more about how they can sort of pursue a career or just get involved in a fun way through our 50-word fiction competition. We also even have an online agony aunt. So there's lots of different things. And again, hopefully there's something for writers at any stage of their career or of all ages.
RNIB have a writing competition. If someone listening has entered that and wants to further their writing career, what can they do?
Well, there's lots of things they can do. They can have a look at our website where we have lots of information and advice and can also signpost to other organisations. But I think probably our biggest programmes, our projects rather, is our New Writers Awards, where we take talented writers from across Scotland and we work with them intensively over a year. We provide them with a bursary of £2,000 so that they can free up some time. They get to go to Cove Park to spend time working on their writing. Cove Park is an artist's residency programme. We also provide them with PR and presentation training and mentoring, and there's all sorts of things. I mean, really, the purpose of the New Writers Awards is that we can't give intensive support to every single talented writer in Scotland. So what we do is we open our doors up and we take on sort of between 10 and 12 writers each year, and we work with them. And once we've got them, we never really let them go. So, and that's the New Writers Awards, and we would strongly encourage as many people as possible to apply.
And now more from this year's Book Week Scotland book, Rebel.
A Ravenscraig picture, written and read by Des McAnulty. Hello, my name is Felicia. I would like to tell you a story about what happened to me not long after I came to live here in Scotland. In August 2004, I moved to a town just outside Glasgow called Motherwell. I left my home in Krakow, Poland, where I had lived all my life, to start a new life with my daughter, Dominika, and her husband, Bartek. We chose Motherwell because it already had an established Polish community, and people from our country had been coming here since before the war. Our decision to emigrate was brought on by a number of factors. Dominika had always wanted to train to be a nurse. She spoke often of working within the great NHS in the United Kingdom. Bartek was a joiner by trade, but struggled to find regular work in Krakow. They both enrolled in English classes and remained determined to leave Poland for a new life here. I was very happy with this and encouraged them in their collective endeavours. It was not unusual for Polish children to work in another country and send some money back home. I admit the idea of some extra cash coming to me regularly was something that I was quite happy about. Not long before Bartek and Dominika received their papers to come and work and study in Scotland, we had some bad news. My husband, Olav, who had been suffering poor health, sadly passed away. As Dominika was my only daughter, the thought of being alone in Krakow scared me somewhat. So much so, Bartek suggested that I come to live with them in Scotland. I reluctantly agreed. Uprooting my whole life and moving to another country was daunting for me. I tried to put a brave face on. My anxiousness, the polar opposite of my daughter and her husband's excitement. We managed to find a nice little flat on Watson Street, which was near the town's main centre. Dominika enrolled in a nursing degree and Bartek found some work in a nearby building site. I wanted to make a contribution, so for the first time in my life, I found a job of my own. I was to be a cleaner for an office on Mary Street. I was to clean for 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours at night. It wasn't much, but it allowed me to meet some local people and learn more about the town I now called home. One night, just as I was about to finish my shift, I happened upon a framed picture that caught my attention. It was a striking image of what looked like a massive industrial plant. It showed two large looming blue towers with a distinctive S displayed on each. Parallel to them was what looked like two great big cooling towers. Behind them, a solitary flame that seemed to be burning from a chimney, like an Olympic torch. I was so taken by this, I stopped in at the library on my way home to try and learn more about this wonderful image that I had saw. The librarian was very helpful. When I told him I wasn't very good with computers, he gave me some old paper cuttings and books. The place was called Ravenscraig. It was the biggest steel plant in Scotland, and it was situated a mile from where I was now. I pored over the books and the cuttings. I read about how Ravenscraig was the lifeblood of the town, and generations of men would work there together. I read stories from former workers, from wives and mothers of boys who grew into men on that plant. I also read of its sad demise, of how its closure affected the whole area, and the politics that were involved. More importantly though, I read about its legacy, and how the people of Motherwell and Wishaw still hold it close in their hearts, and why it will always be a reminder of the town's history. All of this had a profound effect on me, so it came as a great surprise when, the following week, as I was doing my cleaning, someone had taken the picture down and replaced it with a more modern-looking effort, a skyline of some American city. I could not believe it. This was a symbol of Motherwell and all it stood for. I immediately made my way down to the bins outside. Unfortunately, they were gone, taken by the bin men. That night, I walked home with tears in my eyes. How could young people discard their history in such a way, like it was nothing? That night, I found myself in Motherwell Library again. This time, I asked the same librarian to go into the internet and find what I was looking for. I gave him my postcard and the meagre savings held in it. With my permission, he made the purchase. 2 days later, it arrived. I ripped open the package and there it was, the same picture, only an artist's impression. I carried it to work and waited till everyone had left. When I was sure I was alone, I took down the new picture and discarded it into the outside bins. I replaced it with the Ravenscraig picture I had purchased and waited my fate. Sure enough, the next day I was called into the manager's office and told I was being dismissed for gross misconduct. Apparently I had been caught on a camera disposing the new picture, but I had no regrets. I felt I had done what I had to do. I have a new job now, working for a family on Hamilton Road, cleaning their lovely big house. I never found out what happened to the picture. They never asked me if I wanted it back. I hope it's in a place where it can be seen for a long time to come.
Rebel Boots by Amy Moreno. Rebel boots, big and clunky, their rubber soles thick and chunky, worn through the years on my changing feet, rebelling, learning, itchy, neat. Born to stomp round in my teens underneath angry baggy jeans. Not for me, high heels designer, I'm granddad's little 5 foot miner. 20s, travel, music, books, pink hair piercings, eclectic looks. Worn to parties, lectures, interviews, no trainers, pumps or black court shoes. Still clunky, comfy, keep me grounded, but these 30s shapes are softer, rounded. Wee handprints on my clothes and boots, my rebel feet have put down roots. Not itchy feet now, but here to stay, to read bedtime stories, cook and play. But I still wear my clunky boots, with my two little rebels in cahoots.
Wisconsin, read by Alec Porter. It was the 60s, to be exact the summer of 1969, the sputtering embers of that hot, fervid decade. Of course, we didn't know that at the time. The 60s is a later invention, a social, political and cultural inferno that, safely over, has been elevated to the realm of untouchable saintliness. It's what happened to Martin Luther King, Muhammad Ali and John Lennon. Now they are celebrated, but at the time, they were a menace to J. Edgar Hoover and all things decent. They became truly good only by being truly dead, like the 60s. I was 15 in 69, a schoolboy at Stirling High School, a not very good schoolboy, shortly to be expelled. Bob Dylan had just been installed as the soundtrack to my small existence, and the rest was football, or not quite. In the evenings, through the medium of my family's crackling black and white telly, the revolution was, indeed, being televised. Berkeley, Vietnam, the Sorbonne, Martin, Malcolm, and float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. A single blow to the top of the TV, you had to synchronise vertical and horizontal hold, and this world came into our wee council house. I lapped it up. Then, one day, she was from Wisconsin, a student teacher doing one term at Stirling. Blonde, early 20s, bespectacled. Let's just call her Missconsin. A regular teacher introduced her, then left her to it. It was Modern Studies, Period 1, a Monday in May. Ooh, the smell of napalm in the morning. She walked into it. I'm sitting there with the rest of the class, all Pictish, proletarian and slightly perplexed. A real American in front of us? Well, if that don't beat all. She introduced herself geographically. Wisconsin is the dairy state, lots of cows. Then, I come from a town just a horse ride from Milwaukee. That's what she said, a horse ride. Then she gives us the patriot riff. My country, big country, beautiful country, powerful country, space age country. Why, just the best darn country in the world. Then she reaches into her bag on the desk, plucks out a picture frame, walks across the classroom and places the frame on top of the tannoy speaker. She turns to the class and says, with a big smile, what immaculate dentistry. This is our president. And that's how I come to find myself staring into the droopy, bloodhound visage of Richard Milhouse Nixon. I could practically hear a smile rippling through that classroom. My classmates sat back, pens and pencils were laid down, and I heard someone behind me go, yes! See, they all knew what was coming, knew that there would be no work done this period. I had previous. In retrospect, someone should have warned her, given her a hint. The revolution had only reached Stirling in a heavily diluted solution, but darn it, someone had to keep her end up. I had taken to discussing contemporary events with certain teachers. Invariably that meant the normal educative process was suspended. I could keep it going for an entire period. I was the darling of my classmates. I even got free ciggies at the smokers' union. Wisconsin was, well, what Yanks would call a slam dunk. I'll give you the staccato version of the duet. I put my hand up, she went for it. Imperialism, freedom and democracy, Selma, lynching. My president is a great man. No, he's no. He is.
Ho Chi Minh, Communism is Evil, Agent Orange, Burning Bairns, We Put Men on the Moon, Che, Those Students Should Behave, They Are Behaving, John Wayne, Sitting Bull, Elvis, Lennon, Bobby Darin, Who? Some of my fellow pupils had their heads on their desks. Extra Z's courtesy of... I was at least two ciggies up. Slavery, the Panthers. Dr. King went too far. K-San, the Klan. Law and order is the American way. Muhammad Ali. His name is Cassius Clay. Custer had it coming. Ah, boys, Marine Corps. Hendrix, just noise. Dylan, Gene Pitney. Who? General Motors, Janis Joplin. Oh, heck, come on. Olympics, clench fist. Traitors to their country. What? Then the bell goes. End of period one. We ain't gone to work on Maggie's farm. Thursday evening, same week. I slip into school easy. Always clubs and night classes on. I sneak upstairs. Modern studies. The classroom is unlocked. Friday, period one, modern studies. Nothing is said, but I know all eyes are fixed on me. When she comes in, she simply stops, hesitates for a moment, and steps over the glass and paper debris at her feet. Good morning, class, she says, and removes her spectacles, wipes them on her sleeve, and puts them back on. No one says a word. We are just waiting. Then she walks over, picks up the twisted portrait frame, and, very slowly and deliberately, she pushes all the broken glass into the corner with her foot. Then she bends down and picks up every torn fragment of the picture of her president and places them in the bin. She looks at me and smiles. That big smile. Behind her glasses, I can see a wee twinkle in her eyes. She goes to her bag and pulls out a clone, a replica. The next moment, I am... once again, face to face with Tricky Dicky. Then I realise, Wisconsin doesn't just want to win. No, she wants full spectrum domination. A hard rain was gonna fall.
Fairy Cakes, written by Zoe Sutherland. My mum is good at baking. She makes lovely fairy cakes. When I was a little girl, I would help her. When they had cooled down, my mum would put the icing on them and sprinkles. I would have to wait until it was time to eat them, but sometimes that was quite hard. So I would pinch one and lick off the icing.
We'll have our last few Book Week Scotland stories in a moment, but once again, let's hear from the Scottish Book Trust.
I'm Katrina Wallace, I'm the head of early years at Scottish Book Trust, and my job involves working with our youngest audience, right from birth up to age about five. We run the BookBug programme, which is free packs of books for every child in Scotland at set stages to help support them and their families really enjoy stories, songs and rhymes right from the start.
So how do you engage readers before they go to school?
Well, we really believe that a love of stories can start right from when a child is born. We know that the parent's voice or the carer's voice is the most important thing to that child. And so even when a baby can't respond and talk back to you and tell you what they like about the story, they're still going to be getting a lot out of hearing that familiar voice, building a really strong relationship with the important adult in their life. And it's not just about books, it's also about songs and rhymes and laying those early, very, very early foundations that will later lead on to literacy, hopefully, and a love of reading. And we also have BookBug sessions, which are free story, song and rhyme sessions for children between birth and five and their families. You can come along for free to your local library and join in with lots of fun. And if you go to one during Book Week Scotland, you'll get a special Book Week Scotland sticker as well.
So I'm in primary one. What do I get?
Well, you get an amazing pack of books of your very own. It comes in a little canvas bag with a handle that's the right size for a five-year-old. the best thing is that the primary ones get to actually keep the books for themselves.
So what happens after primary one?
After primary one, we hand over to our schools team, who then take children on a sort of a broader love of reading. We have a whole range of programmes that engage with children through school, things like our Authors Live programme. We have a touring programme to take well-known authors around Scotland to places where they might not normally reach. And we have a whole range of other resources available on our website to allow children to engage directly, but also to support teachers and learning professionals with encouraging just that love of reading. What we're really about is making sure that children have the opportunity to read what they want and that they're really encouraged to read for pleasure as well as what they'll be doing in school. And you can find out more at our website, which is www.scottishbooktrust.com.
Thanks to Katrina, who's away on maternity leave at the moment. Now, let's have our final batch of stories from this year's Scottish Book Trust Book Week Scotland book, Rebel.
Au Revoir, Petite Rebellion, written and read by Alistair L.R.I. Hodgson. There is no such thing as a free ride, unless the ride in question is on the Paris Metropolitan. But even then, sweltering, you descend underground into Lomiere, shunted to and fro amidst the late afternoon chaos. You are tethered to your pitiami by palms loosened with sweat, or loosened with something psychological, an unconscious choice. The boiling sea of heaving, sweating bodies pulsates and shifts around you, never casting the same shadow twice. Everyone has somewhere to be, and nobody can spare a second of the time it takes to get there. At the ticket gates, she usually scans her pass and raises her arms. You grab her waist, press your bodies together, and the pair of you slip through as one. Maybe you plant a kiss between the freckles on her sun-soft neck. On any other day, you revel in the intimacy, the sensation of sharing this modest act of defiance. But this time there is distance. It doesn't feel intentional, but it doesn't feel like an accident either. This time she's a step too far ahead, and you're weighed down with the ballast for a return flight. You pass through the turnstile, but your heat-seeking charcoal hold-all snags, and the body-length barrier ahead snaps shut. You try to retreat, but the turnstile, aptly named Tourniquet, has locked in place, as securely as the barrier, leaving you marooned, constricted between the two. You panic, but the only alarm bell ringing is deep between your ears, vibrating the length of your spine. She waits impatiently, back to the filthy tiled wall, toe-tapping, Parisian pout saying she's as unimpressed with you as she is with the rest of the world. And this might be the beginning of the end of your world, the short time you have enjoyed, together. A murmured commentary begins from the commuters in what passes for a queue behind you. Putain, imbécile, espèce d'idiot. From the ticket booth, an attendant's eyes watch over the top of a newspaper, rolling with haughty indifference, as only the eyes of a Parisian official can do. You're just another Brit, a tourist taking the piss. If you're going to jump the tourniquet, at least do it discreetly, if not quickly, if not stylishly. There is an art to it, a finesse, a certain je ne sais quoi, that you do not seem to possess. You hoist your hold all over the top and sprackle up after it, springing off the barrier with a gallant gallus flourish, as though you're hopping stiles, field to field, in the Selkirkshire valleys. Suffice to say, no matter how much you think you look like the leader of your own private revolution, no dignity is recovered. You get away with it, at cost to your pride instead of your wallet, and a heightened sense of sticking out like a sore thumb in a land of manicured fingers. You thought you could walk the walk, you thought you knew the lingo, but, as it turns out, you simply do not speak their language. You don't know the Régie Autonome des Transports Parisiennes, who advertise themselves on every ticket you don't buy, and you don't need to. You're transitory, passing through in your own awkward way, never around for long, and the very definition of a poor student. A poor student in Paris, not a great combo. A poor vegetarian student in Paris, even worse. But you'll be dining in Scotland tonight. Small comforts. Now you're on the other side, down some more steps, shrugging off her hand with your embarrassment. A welcome blast of air announces the train, the orange line to Gare de l'Est, where you will connect to Gare du Nord. You are bound for Charles de Gaulle, another place named after some dead French rebel. You won't be coming back.
Drinking Games, written and read by David Lamond. I used to think drinking was cool. I longed to be 18 so I could sit in the pub and get royally hammered. And that's what happened. I spent the best years of my youth drinking my ass off. Is there a bar here? What time is it open till? Do you mind if I get messed up? These early years of drinking coincided with the onset of my mental health condition. I drank when I was up, I drank when I was down, I drank when I was only halfway up. The grand old Duke of Booze. Everything I learned as a young adult was learned under the influence or hungover as hell. Bring paranoia and depression into the mix, and I'm lucky that I didn't cause myself more damage than I did. Drinking for me was a rebellious act. I started boozing on holiday in Switzerland at the age of 13. After that, I was always looking forward to events where I might be able to score a few drinks. However, this isn't really a tale of alcohol woe. It's more one of how I deal now with the desire to get drunk, and how rebellious this state of mind is, and how it might help you or someone you know. During one bout of heavy drinking, I was surprised to hear that anything over 5 or 6 units of alcohol was classified as a binge. For me, 5 or 6 units was a regular midweek mini-session. I think in the future, the government will dispense units of alcohol to your house, 1 or 2 units at a time. The alcohol would have to have some massively corrosive half-life to stop you stockpiling it around Christmas time though. I can remember telling this tale of what essentially amounted to civil servants becoming the milkmen of an alcohol delivery service. This one chap thought it was such a good idea that he bought me a drink. One of the things I miss about drinking is the way it opened your mind. Ideas and jokes seem to come quicker after a drink, but it's a small price to pay, really. Then there is stuff you bleat out and think, I'd never think of that in a month of Sundays. You declare your genius to the world. With stuff like, the trouble with Kafka was that he was an intolerable Czech lightweight. Essentially, I was throwing a massive degree of caution to the wind. And now teetotal and never allow a drop of alcohol to pass my lips. Now that I've stopped drinking, when I am at my best, I see it like a game. A game that you win by not giving in to the desire to get drunk. For me, this means total abstinence. I'm sorry for having allowed alcohol to take over my life. It's the same with cigarettes. Philip Morris and I are toe-to-toe in a fistfight. He tempts me with half-finished cigs left in bus stops. I run around town like a manic preacher, slapping fags out of the young ones' mouths. So that's it. Life is hard, but it's only made harder by cigarettes and alcohol. This story is ongoing. The game is never won. It's more like trying to keep a clean sheet. I thought that when I was drinking and smoking, I was being a rebel. But really, I'm more of a rebel now. I am changing into a better human being. I do get help from my medication, but the side effects make them as much of a hindrance as a help. As far as the meds versus booze debate goes, you really just have to trust your doctor. I've learned that through painful experience. Booze is a bad medicine. I read somewhere that Bill Hicks stopped drinking and smoking before he died. He still espoused all the rebellious, humorous claptrap he was famous for, though. That's how I see myself now. A sober Bill Hicks, but not as funny, and hopefully not dead before I'm 40. It seems to me a sober rebel is somehow more difficult to control than a drunken one. Sobering up is like a drug in itself.
This is Mibby's Aye, Mibby's No, written and read by Anne Brown. I've never thought of myself as being any kind of rebel. And I can't mind a time when I rebelled against anything. Maybe I'm a wee bit thrawn, as my mother used to say. But then she always had a front for folk. Dinna be yourself, behave, dinna show me up. Repression was her byword. Like when I wanted my ears pierced when I was 14, and my mother prattled on about if the Lord meant you to have holes in your ears, you'd be born with them. And mere nonsense about it making you look cheap. I was thrown about it and borrowed some studs from a pal, raided mother's sewing box for a darning needle and did it myself. The blood running down my neck and tears and snot frae greeting with the pain day in the first one made me stop for a minute, though. Do I carry on? Maybe's no. It's sair. My mother will kill me. It's sair. I'll be in the bad books for years. It's sair. I'll have to get earrings of my own. It's sair. Maybe's aye. I'll have pierced ears. I won. This thrawn bit of me was missing when I married my first man, though. I was 16 and thought it was a good idea. But once it was all booked, I just kent it wasn't right. I tried to call it off, but my mother went daft. So do I call it off? Maybe's aye and heave a huge sigh of relief, but have my mother on my back again. She'd be black affronted and I'd never live it down. My life wouldn't be worth living. Everybody would be talking about me. Maybe's no and do what she wants. Go with the flow. Then you rock the boat. What canna be cured must be endured. You've made your bed, lie in it. Dinna get above yourself. Dinna let folk down. All that burled round in my head and I ended up going with no. 13 miserable years later, I had the same thoughts. Do I run for the hills? Maybe's aye, freedom, a life, the start of something good. Maybe's no and stay in the rut of my life. Maybe's aye won, so I went to college. Found stuff I was good at, found folk I liked, found my voice and found me. Then I ran for the hills and freedom. Well, as free as you can be, with two wains, two dugs, a horse, a wreck of a car and nae money. That same street got me through getting a council flat, starting frae scratch with furniture, getting a job, getting another horse, carrying on studying to get a better job, getting together with somebody I'd been pals with for years, moving in together, buying a house together, getting married and having a great job, great life, holidays abroad, the wains growing up and leaving home. I'd found myself and my future. Then MS found me. It barged into my life and changed everything I knew about me. Was I going to have to reinvent myself as being a disabled person? A pale wee soul that folk looked at with their pitying expressions, rubbed your arm and spoke at you loud and slow. Are you all right there? Feeling smug that they're doing a good thing. Was that my future? Maybe's aye and I'd turn into this helpless person that folk expected and be grateful for them even spending a bit of their day to chat to me. I'd have nae expectations of achieving anything in the future. Just become what folk's perceptions of a wee disabled person should be in day. I'd have to be grateful for what I've got and no push against it, as I shouldn't be doing stuff with my condition. Well, if that was the deal, then I didn't have a choice. Maybe's no it was, wherever that was going to take me. When I had to gee up work, it took me to studying nutrition, getting a fitness regime and fighting to be the best I can be. Was that being thrown or rebelling against a label in a shrinking world? I didn't ken, but it's got me on the back of a horse and after years of working at it all the way to the RDA National Championships, doing dressage where I was fourth in my class. I've jumped out a plane, twice did a firewalk, got my arse tattooed with the RDA slogan, "It's what you can do that counts," and I volunteer to keep me sane and productive. This year I had a big birthday, and I'm still semi-upright, so I decided to spend it having fun and raise some money for charity. I've been whitewater rafting, had 13 inches of my hair cut off, did a vaulting routine, that's gymnastic moves on the back of a moving horse. Went to Wales to ride the fastest zip warrior in the world with pals. 5 years. 2 broken old women and 3 fit gay men. What a road trip that was. And there's still more planned. I dinna ken what all this says about me, except I've decided that I have MS, but it doesna have me or define who or what I am. So does that make me a bit of a rebel after all? Maybe's aye.
The Conformist, written and read by Blethering Skite. You're writing a story about a rebel? Well, you're not getting one. You hear me? You're not telling me what to say. write about what I want to. I want to dance to your tune, your terms and conditions, your perfect renditions of some toff's idea poetry. I'll break all your rules, make you look like fools. Scratch that, dictators. See, I even left in my mistake. How will that sit with the neat nanny state that wants all its words on a neoliberal plate? Hey, I think I'll put a wee bit of politics in the middle of the story. Something like, all vote Tory. Just for a laugh. Where'd you get off? Telling me what's funny or no? I'm going to say what I want. I might even have a sly rant. Shouting and screaming my words like litter, the junk food it feeds, the hash plants of Twitter. You winna publish my words anyway. You're no brave enough. You'll be like, she said this, so she's a wee besom, full of cheek and whatchamacallitism. Shut her up fast, she needs a good shushing. Inject her with poison, tell the world it was the That's it, end of discussion. See, I even know what you were thinking, even if you didn't say it. And no, I winna read your rules carefully before I apply.
Alas, that's all we've got time for on today's show. But if you want to hear more stories from Rebel, there's a free ebook or audio version available at either Scottish Book Trust, all one word, .com, or just search for Book Week Scotland and follow the links to Rebel.
Now, there are a few days left of Book Week Scotland. Back over to Philippa Cochran.
It's Book Week Scotland. There's loads of events taking place all over the country. Lots of different ways that you can take part via our website. The contact details you need at www.bookweekscotland.com. And if you do nothing else, go and visit your library or your local bookshop and just find a book that you love.
And if you want more from Read On, you can always head to our Audio Boom page. All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews and exclusive author interviews. There's a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk. So, until next week, farewell and remember to read on.
Okay. Do the Scottish accent. Do the...
And until next week, remember to read on.
Okay, moving on.